This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Welcome back to The Morning Run. I'm Roshan Kanesan with Lynn Mark and Noel Lim in the studio this morning. Now, in a half an hour, we've got the breakfast grill and we've got a particularly special one today. Noel, why don't you tell us what's happening today?
Right, we'll be speaking with Tun Dr. Mahathir Mohamad, or rather, I will be speaking to him. He returns to the grill this time as former Prime Minister. So I'm going to ask him about why he resigned as PM during Lanka Sheraton when he did not have to. And also, I want to explore with him Pejuang's role in the next GE and his old score with Dato' Sri Anwar Ibrahim.
The tale that keeps on going, really. But anyway, we're taking a look beyond this. So that's happening at 8 a.m. on the Breakfast Grill. Right now, we're taking a look at the Middle East. The Gulf Cooperation Council Summit held last week saw Gulf leaders sign an agreement ending a three-year blockade with Qatar. The now fully restored relations with Saudi Arabia, UAE, Bahrain and Egypt brings an end to years of destructive diplomatic tensions which severely affected Qatar's economy and undermined its sovereignty. In fact, I think Qatari planes had to go around the regions. They take longer routes to get to their destinations.
So the good news has been quite well received, but there are lingering issues that continue to divide the Middle East. It's been reported that Iran is now looking into possible atomic weapons production, and with President Trump taking his leave from the White House next week, what will become of his Middle East policies and which direction will the Biden administration take with U.S. Middle East relations?
All important questions, and we will be diving into them now with James Dorsey, Senior Fellow at the Rajaratnam School of International Studies and the Middle East Institute. James, thank you so much for joining us this morning. Now, the three-year blockade against Qatar has now been lifted and after signing of a solidarity and stability agreement among Gulf leaders. How was this diplomatic rift actually resolved?
Pleasure to be with you. I don't think that what we're seeing in the Gulf, as well as other parts of the Middle East, solutions to conflicts. What we are seeing is a shaving off of the raw ends. With other words, a dialing down of the belligerent language and belligerent attitude. But that's primarily for two reasons. One, in anticipation of the incoming Biden administration in the United States, and because all of the Middle Eastern states need foreign direct investment, and for that, they need to create at least the facade of some degree of stability. None of the underlying problems that have driven conflict in the Middle East have been resolved, and those conflicts will remain, and then not being put on ice, they're just going to be fought out in different ways.
Why didn't they have that same kind of motivation to get together and to mend ties under Trump's administration?
Well, I think for two reasons. One is there was no pressure for them to do so. With other words, Trump's policies were not conducive to that. You have a Biden administration coming in with a president who has in the past been sharply critical of various policies of Middle Eastern states, including those of Saudi Arabia, of Israel, of Turkey. And the other reason why was because many of those states felt encouraged by the Trump administration. So the Trump administration, when President Trump made his first trip abroad, which remarkably was not to a Western U.S. ally, but to Saudi Arabia. In Saudi Arabia, the message at the time that the Saudis took away from the visit was that they could go ahead with all kinds of policies and would find support for it in the White House. And de facto, they did over the last 4 years. And by the same token, you've had a policy towards Israel, which encouraged and supported explicitly the hard line of the Netanyahu government, rather than a political line that would be more geared towards compromise.
So overall then, James, what does this peace agreement mean for Qatar's relations with Iran? Despite Iran's violation of the 2015 nuclear deal, and now it appears to also be working on a possible atomic weapons production.
I don't think it means anything. With other words, first of all, if you look at the agreement that was reached in Saudi Arabia among the Gulf states, none of the demands that have been put forward, the 13 demands by the boycotting states led by Saudi Arabia and the UAE, have been met by Qatar. Nor is Qatar under any pressure, really, to meet those demands. And those demands were frankly unacceptable to Qatar because they would have been meant de facto the end of Qatari sovereignty. But moreover, Qatar's relationship with Iran is one in which Qatar's a state, a small state, sandwiched between two regional behemoths, Saudi Arabia and Iran, both of which it views as partners, but also as potential threats. On top of that, Qatar and Iran share the world's largest offshore gas field. They have to deal with each other. And when you look at Qatar's dealings with Iran, for example, trade, Qatari trade with Iran is less than the United Arab Emirates trade with Iran today. So de facto, nothing is going to change. With regard to the nuclear agreement, Iran's moving away from the provisions of that agreement are a function of the United States having withdrawn from the agreement and imposed harsh economic sanctions. Most of the world, including Qatar, but part of the United States and certainly its Western allies, are very critical of that U.S. policy.
So speaking of the U.S. then, James, looking forward, what can we expect from Joe Biden's administration when it comes to the Middle East? Do you think he will undo much of Trump's existing policies? What direction will he take going forward?
I think the proof will be in the pudding. Obviously, once you walk into the White House or into the Oval Office, the world looks very different and the pressures are very different. Having said that, it's been clear that he is going to pursue a policy or try to pursue a policy that is far more even-handed, that is likely going to restructure, not dump U.S. commitments in the region, but restructure them. And he's going to have a greater emphasis on human rights, on fundamental freedoms, including freedom of expression, rule of law. Now, what the Trump administration has done, particularly in these last days, is to try and put in place policies and measures that are going to make it more difficult for the Biden administration to roll back. And we'll have to see how he does that. But overall, I think what you're going to see is a very different tone, a very different approach, a much more professional approach. You're going to get an administration less of ideologues and more of professionals with a far-reaching experience in foreign policy. And that is going to make a significant difference. And that is what Middle Eastern states are anticipating.
James, could you give us shed some light onto some of these policies that the Trump administration could be putting in place now that could make Biden's administration, that could hamper Biden's own initiatives?
Well, you can start with the recognition of Jerusalem and the move of the U.S. embassy. That's a policy that Biden would not have implemented, but he cannot roll back. And the reason he cannot roll back is because U.S. law, for the longest period of time, has dictated that the United States should recognize Jerusalem as the capital of Israel and put its embassy there. The reason it didn't happen until Trump was that every incoming administration basically postponed the decision. Now that it has been implemented, there's no way that Biden can turn that back. And that obviously is going to create a difficulty as you try and mediate an agreement between the Israelis and the Palestinians. Some of the sanctions that have been put in place are going to be, first of all, when Biden comes to dealing with Iran and trying to bring the United States back to the nuclear agreement, he is going to have to deal with three different issues. One is domestic politics. There is Iran is not the most favored country in the United States. And many in the U.S. Congress, including members of the Democratic Party, are not in favor of making concessions to Iran. Some, including Chuck Schumer, who is now going to be the majority leader in the U.S. Senate, voted in 2015 against the nuclear agreement. Second of all, he's going to have to deal with an Iran that, on the one hand, is becoming more hardline as a result of U.S. policy in part, is looking at presidential elections in June and feels aggrieved by the Trump policy, is going to want to see compensation for the economic damage imposed by the sanctions, and is going to be more reluctant to negotiate issues that go beyond the nuclear agreement, including its relations with all kinds of non-state actors in Lebanon, Iraq, and in Yemen, and also going to be more reluctant to negotiate limits on its military programs, particularly its development of ballistic missiles.
James, thank you so much for your time this morning. That was James Dorsey, Senior Fellow at the S. Rajaratnam School of International Studies and the Middle East Institute. And a really interesting way James is painting out the situation over there in the Middle East. And I think he started off by basically saying, this may not be exactly what we think it is, right? And there's still a lot of work that needs to be done in the Middle East. Lynn, what were your key takeaways from the conversation over there?
I was intrigued by his thoughts on kind of the difference between the Trump and the Biden administration when it comes to the Middle East, because it's true, you know, Trump himself was a very divisive figure within his own country, and you could say that he did foster that even in external geopolitics as well. So with Biden coming in, kind of a steady, he portrays himself as a steady hand, an old professional hand at the wheel. Are we going to see kind of a return to sort of pre-Trump, more stable geopolitical diplomatic ties?
Well, the view from the White House is very different once you enter, and the expectations of what is expected, I guess, will also be different. So we'll have to see how Biden actually does and what he actually does when he goes into office. But right now, we're going into a few messages. When we come back, we'll be talking about Sinovac vaccine. Stay tuned to BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.